Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. We've made it talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining. Our journalist and novelist, Margaret Wappler.
Hi there, Guy.
Oh, Margaret. How's your week going?
It's going pretty good. I took a lot of naps yesterday. Oh, I liked that.
That's important.
Yeah.
That's important. And we've got pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Tongson.
Hey, Guy. Hi, Rocketeers. Ooh, I croaked with that one.
Karen.
Well, at practice.
You're back to us from Asia.
I am back to you from Asia. My body is still 15 hours ahead of everyone else's here. So right now I'm fairly lucid, but who knows what will happen as the show progresses.
You're actually just a hologram right now in here.
Pretty much.
Are you going to bring us pop culture from the future?
I will.
Okay. And Winter is on assignment. So this week we've got with us author, filmmaker, and one half of the Max Fun podcast Reading Glasses, Mallory O'Mara. Mallory, what should the Rocketeers know about you?
Well, I'm a book devourer. I was sent back from the future, much like our friend here, to only consume books, and I'm doing a pretty good job of it so far.
What do you look for in a binding? What's most delicious?
I actually like a nice loose binding. I'm a spine cracker.
Okay.
So I really want to get in there.
Oh, nice. Mm. Nice. Do you like a nice fresh book, or do you like the smell of something from like the 1915 or so?
You know, I swing both ways.
Fair. All right, coming up on this week's show, because we got Mallory here, we're going to be talking about our reading habits.
Hey.
Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest gems. First, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Margaret Wappler, what are you all about this week?
Well, continuing on my podcast devourment, I have another one to recommend from you guys. That's also from the magical Facebook list of recommendations that you should all go check out if you need a podcast to go listen to. Habitat. It's from Gimlet Media. It's with Lynn Levy, who is a Radiolab alum, and she basically tracks six or so people who went into the Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation, otherwise known as High Seas, which is basically these people living in a dome, like a tent, a giant tent, near an active volcano. Actually, I'm not sure if it's active or not, but it didn't blow up, so don't worry about that. Near a volcano in Hawaii, and it's all supposed to simulate Mars. And they cannot leave this tent. They may not leave. If they leave, they have to be in a spacesuit, just like if they were on a spaceship in Mars. So it's all about NASA studying basically the physical and social dynamics of people trapped together in space. They all come from different walks of life. There's a doctor, there's a Frenchman, there is an engineer.
There's always a Frenchman.
Yes, and he has
a
wonderful accent. And apparently is also like the one that managed to be a celeb out of all of this because France cared a lot more about high seas than we did. It's very funny and also sweet in its own way.
Is there anyone you just hate?
Well, there's somebody that they all hate. There is a person in the group that they all kind of turn against. But I don't even want to say who it is because I think that's part of the fun of discovering who they turn against. But I actually had empathy for this person. Don't think she was as bad as they made her out to be. But when you're trapped with somebody for a year, I don't know. I'm sure you hate everyone.
I mean, the thing is, we've logged hundreds of hours in this egg-crated little room. They are not consecutive, but still, I think we have some valuable data.
I think so, too. But, you know, the thing that's never happened to us is we've never had to clean each other's poop out of the toilet.
Wait.
Not yet.
Right. That's coming.
Mallory, what are you all about this week?
I'm listening to this audiobook that I'm just wicked obsessed with. It's called Text Me When You Get Home by Kayleen Schaefer. And it's all about, it's like half memoir, half history, half essays, all about female friendships and like the history of female friendships and the history of how female friendships have been repressed. Like historical writings were written in a way by men that they just like, oh, no, women can't be friends with each other. So other women, it sort of like became a self-licking ice cream cone where women were like, oh, why would I want to hang out with other women? I'm reading all these books that say that women are mean to each other. Ugh. You know, fuck chicks.
Yeah.
And it just sort of perpetuated to the point where it wasn't until, you know, this century that, like, there was a lot of pop culture and it talks about a lot of TV shows, a lot of movies that sort of talk about, like, showcase female friendship in a way that isn't around men, isn't around marriage, and isn't around trying to get a guy. And this book is incredible. The audiobook is wicked, wicked good. I'm like a two-thirds of the way through and it's like every 5 minutes I want to text my two best friends and be like, I love you guys so much. And, like, I've recommended it to so many women. I totally, totally recommend this book. Is amazing.
What is a great historical or pop culture friendship that she highlights that you're in love with?
Well, she talks about Golden Girls. It's interesting because every pop culture reference, she kind of gives a counter reference. And for Golden Girls, it was Elaine from Seinfeld. She's like, they didn't write Elaine as a girl. And that was why it was appealing to a lot of women, but it was also sort of inaccurate because she, like, you know, they're like, oh, she's just a man with lady clothes. And like,
the only time you ever really sense that she's a woman is when she goes hunting New York for the Today sponge.
Yes, that I remember was a great that episode.
That was a really good one. Good and episode. The masturbation challenge where her dynamics were a little different.
How do you feel about a hybrid memoir like that? Like, do you feel like it's a cop out?
I'm writing one, so I'm super into it.
Well, I was just using this as an opportunity to promote my book, My Life as a Goddess, coming out July 31st.
If you buy mine. What,
you got a title?
Yeah, Lady from the Black Lagoon.
Is it available for pre-order on Amazon? Or?
Not yet. I'm actually not done writing it. My pub date is sometime in March next year.
Look, I mean, they had mine up when I wasn't done writing with it, so you never know.
Who's publishing it?
It's a HarperCollins imprint called Hanover Square Press.
Exciting. Okay, but it should probably be up there any moment.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah. It's really, really, we're really, really close, which makes me want to barf a little bit. But I'm very excited.
In what way is it a hybrid?
So what my book's about? There's a woman named Millicent Patrick, and she's the woman who designed the creature from the Black Lagoon. And when the movie was about to come out, they're like, "Oh my God, this is wicked awesome lady who designed this creature. We should send her out on a press tour to promote it. The beauty who created the beast." And they sent her out, and the guy who ran the Universal Monster Shop was so jealous of the attention that she was getting that he blacklisted her, fired her, and she was never heard from ever again.
Whoa.
And no one knew what happened to her, and she, except for me. She was always my hero because I knew that she had designed the creature. So I went on a year-long private investigation of her life. I found everything. But I, as like my day job, I'm a filmmaker and I do horror film. So it's sort of like I'm writing about all these horrible things that happened to her. And I'm like, okay, cool. But why is that relevant now? And it is because I am dealing with the same bullshit that she dealt with 60 years ago, like on a daily basis. And like what we can do about it and how I've like found feminism working in the horror film industry, which is what a lot of people would think is a weird place to find it. And, you know, what like my life working in the industry is now for horror and for women working in film. So it's sort of like a Hollywood memoir, a biography, a call to arms for ladies in genre. It's sort of like, so it's like a her chunk and then a me chunk.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that sounds really cool.
Ms. Charkson, what are you all about?
Well, I also have a hybrid memoir.
Each other's hybrid.
Well, it's why Karen Carpenter matters. It won't be out till January 2019, unfortunately, because there are two titles in that Music Matters series coming out first, but I'll keep you all abreast of when it comes. That said, what I'm all about this week is actually something I didn't think I would be all about, and it's Laura Brownson's doc on Rachel Dolezal. I finally learned how to pronounce her last name.
It's Dolezal.
It's Dolezal, called The Rachel Divide, and it just appeared on Netflix this month. And it basically tracks Rachel Dolezal. I mean, you know, she has inside access since her ignominious fall when she's called out for you know, having lied about her racial background. And it's the kind of thing where you're like, well, is this an apologist tale? Is this meant to be something compensatory where we can see the many-sidedness of this matter? And I will say that you can see the many-sidedness of the matter without ever, like, lapsing into some, like, profound sympathy, actually, for Dolezal and what she did, or at all thinking that it had any excuse for it.
Well, there was one woman from Spokane who she was friends with, and she was like, oh, yeah, she was pretending to be black, but she was good for the community. And it reminded me of the old street joke, you know, my brother, he thinks he's a chicken, is why don't you take him to a psychiatrist? We need the eggs.
Well, I mean, it's not unlike Wild Wild Country, where you find yourself at various points thinking, oh, Ma and Aunt Sheila's okay. Like, yeah. She did some, like, fine, but, you know, she did some good work in various ways.
Yeah.
Up until, you know, they're poisoning salad bars, or until you see how insidious and also how her voice completely shunted aside so many other key voices and set the movement back, particularly in Spokane.
She's confusing because, and I haven't seen the documentary, but just from those interviews that she did around the time when the story broke, she's not a dumb woman.
No.
And she does have...
But she's also not a lucid woman, you know?
Yeah. Like, does she come off as more crazy in this doc than those interviews?
I don't know if it's about crazy, but it is about, like, a kind of misuse of knowledge in many respects. I think it's like, I think that she learned a lot of things. She's certainly on the right side of a lot of political issues, but her white womanness comes through insofar as she feels that it is her place to be able to put herself at the center of something instead of being an ally.
Yeah.
Right. And the only way that she can function is to be at the center or the head of something. And her experience is so, so foremost that she can make some lame case about transracialness or cis race or those sorts of things.
Yeah, it's just bizarre to have someone who seemingly understands the issues from a lot of different vantage points, but with this giant hole of emotional and political logic in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's pretty good.
I feel like a kitten. I just want you guys to know that.
What do you mean? Oh, yes. I feel like I've seen you as a kitten in many ways.
Right?
This week, I'm all about a narrative film from Australia that came out like 3 years ago. And I kept seeing it when I would be like, hey, what's Kate Winslet up to? What's Judy Davis up to? And there was this movie that kept coming up, directed by Jocelyn Morehouse, who directed How to Make an American Quilt and 1,000 Acres. She's PJ Hogan's wife, and she sort of hasn't made a movie for the past 15 years. And the movie is called The Dressmaker. And so I, months ago, went to the Wikipedia entry of The Dressmaker and was like, I read it and I was like, well, that doesn't sound like a movie to me. And I finally got to watch it and it's so amazing. Margaret, I feel like both you and Winter would particularly adore this movie. It's about Kate Winslet returns to her hometown. She's a successful clothing designer. It's 1951 in like rural Australia. And the town has rejected her and we don't know why. And it's essentially a Western where she shows back up, but the thing she challenges the town to is that she'll make better dresses for them. And so this town of sloppy, sad, mean, in the worst of senses, mean people suddenly start showing up to her because she can make them glamorous. And the dresses are so wonderful. The story goes in so many directions that wonderful feeling of seeing something you haven't seen before. It's based on a novel. And the narrative was so much not the three-act structure that Save the Cat tells you to write. Liam Hemsworth is also in it, doing such a great job of being, handsome and the dude and likable. But it's, it's not a story you expect, but by the end, it is so delicious and strangely empowering. I cannot recommend watching it enough to Margaret Wappler and Winter Mitchell personally.
Yeah.
To everyone else, I'm like, maybe, maybe not.
I'm feeling it for the Phantom Thread vibes, but in Australia with a woman, specifically Kate Winslet.
I mean, it's if Phantom Thread were a goofy comedy, but also just as macabre.
I was thinking more like Two Wong Fu Things for Everything but Australia in for straight ladies.
I mean, we've already got Two Wong Fu Ba Australian. That's The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Yeah, but first, ladies.
But the four ladies of this and the amount of, there's just the comedy that comes from having these old ladies around town suddenly showing up in couture 1951 gowns that is fucking great.
Where can we watch this?
It was streaming on Amazon.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Delightful.
All right. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back to talk about reading habits after this.
The Dead Pilot Society podcast brings you hilarious comedy pilots that were never made, featuring actors like Aubrey Plaza, Andy Richter, Paul F. Tompkins, John Hodgman, Adam Scott, Molly Shannon, Busy Phillips, Tom Lennon, Anna Camp, Laurie Metcalf, Felicia Day, Michael Ian Black, Adam Savage, Paul Scheer, Ben Schwartz, Skylar Astin, Mae Whitman, Josh Molina, Ben Feldman, Nicole Byer, Jason Ritter, Sarah Chalk, Steve Agee, Jane Levy, Allison Tolman, Danielle Nicolette, Casey Wilson, Anna Ortiz, Lorraine Newman, June Diane Raphael, Kiernan Shipka, Ed Week, Zach Knight, and Carrie Kenny Silver, John Ross Bowie, Jamie Denbo, Janet Varney, Alexander Torsani, Bruce Summer, Natalie Morales, Matt Gordon, and many more. Listen at MaximumFun.org, iTunes, or wherever you download podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Margaret Wappler.
Karen Tongson.
And Mallory O'Mara.
And we're about to go into one of those summery three-day weekends, which means we've got an extra day to try and do what we otherwise would not have time to do. You know, like reading a book. So we're going to talk about the way we read, what we consume, that whole thing. Margaret, you're a fan of books.
Yeah.
When do you do your reading?
Right now, I don't do that much because when I have that kind of time, I write instead of read at this moment. But I can tell you a lot of good baby book jams.
Uh-huh.
But usually when I am in full working order as a reader, I like to read at night. I like to read like for an hour before bed. Like, that's my preferred kind of deal with it. Also, planes, beautiful reading time. Beaches, beautiful reading time. I like to just carry around a book when I'm on the train or I'm like waiting for a friend to show up at dinner or something like that and just sneak like 10 minutes here and there. I find that that way of reading is really like you can blow through a lot of books just doing it that way.
But I mean, the horrible thing is like all three of you are essentially professionals. Like you're somebody who is criticizing books all the time. Karen Thompson, like reading books is like a huge part of your job.
Essentially what I've been doing with my life for the last 20 years.
Tell us about your reading habits.
You know, part of the thing is that I rarely read for pleasure anymore because so much of my profession is reading. Not just reading the novel or rereading the novels and the fiction, the other things, the critical theory that I'm supposed to be teaching, but also I have to read new manuscripts. I edit a book series. So one of the things that I'm doing is constantly reading new work. I have to vet my colleagues' work when we're voting for promotion and merit reviews and things like that. So I have to read their books. And when I have free time, I really just try not to read or read magazines, really. That's why I've switched to like the periodical form or read books of essays and other pieces where I could consume something short and delightful.
Well, is it, I mean, when you're, I imagine your brain is probably used to a certain type of reading material. And is it fun or like disorienting when you come on something that is like something else that isn't academic or 200 years old?
Yeah, it can be fun. It actually can be a lot of fun. And even reading, you know, one of my colleagues happens to be Viet Nguyen, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize winning novel, The Sympathizer. So actually, I ended up reading it because he asked me to do an event with him. And I just couldn't put it down. It was an amazing read. Obviously, it was before he'd won the Pulitzer. Yeah. But, you know, something like Gabrielle Hamilton's memoir, Blood, Bones, and Butter, is something that I just decided, you know what, I'm really into food as a kind of escape or recreation. And so I'm going to read this chef's memoir. And it was really delightful. So I can kind of tell the difference between that and having to read Middlemarch in 3 days for my PhD qualifying exams.
Mallory, when, where, and how do you read?
I guess really the answer to that is when am I not reading?
Mm-hmm.
I read probably 4 to 5 hours a day. But caveat to that, I have no children. I work from home. I'm a writer and a filmmaker. And my partner is also a huge reader. So we wake up every morning and read for an hour over coffee. We read on our lunch break. I read before bed. Well, at night, he watches more TV than I do. So I read while he watches TV. And when I'm doing my yoga, when I'm working out, when I'm doing laundry, doing whatever, I listen to an audiobook. So I like have 3 or 4 books going at the same time. And I just have a lot of time for it. There's no like magic secret. I just read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I read less than you guys. I will read sometimes before bed if I'm not like getting home super late. I'm also a big, huge fan of reading in the bathtub.
Oh, hell yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It is dangerous, God knows. But I've also...
Well, because you use a Kindle?
Well, no. I mean, I just don't want to get books wet.
Oh,
but
that's part of it.
One of the things I had to accept as, like, a young reader was, like, I'm going to put books through a journey. Like, by the time I'm done reading them, they're not going to look like they did at the beginning, and that's okay. It means they were loved.
I spent a lot of time, you know, studying for my qualifying exams, reading in the bathtub. So, and you know, having to read epic like poems or like, you know, Keats's Hyperion in the bathtub for like hours was like a special journey.
I love this idea though of books getting so weathered just from you reading them. I still have this copy of The Outsider Writers from junior high, and I loved that book. And I read it over and over and over again. And literally, it's in rubber band pieces. Like, it doesn't hold together as a book anymore. It just is like several pamphlets that I've rubber banded together, and I can't part with it.
My copy of Pale Fire was essentially torn apart by Minnesota, like, over the course of reading it.
Minnesota will do that to it.
Just between water and wind and snow. Tongson, what are you reading these days?
Like I said, I'm mostly reading manuscripts that I have to vet for publication or magazines. Frankly, I can barely get through my Entertainment Weeklies on a weekly basis. So I'm always stealing time.
Do you have to travel to 1997 to read an Entertainment Weekly?
That's actually when I started subscribing. That is actually when I started subscribing. And they did have those CDs that used to come out with Entertainment Weekly.
Oh, I love them so much.
Yeah. But so it's mostly magazines or the newspaper. So I do read the Los Angeles Times daily, pretty much. I get the Saturday and Sunday paper. So it's like periodicals and stuff I have to read for my research and for my work. I haven't read anything yet this summer. So when I had a whole day on the beach in Thailand, I just listened to music and vegged out and drank a lot of gin and tonics. So
it's not a bad idea.
Off of Mallory,
you did it right.
I also want to say the only time I listen to audiobooks are when I am on a long car trip. But there is something so nice about sort of like for me, audiobooks need to be like very specifically like an Andy Cohen book or something like very the most frivolous. Or like a super dense like history of Canada from before 1600. And either of those will just make the hours speed by. But nothing I need to really care about.
Oh yeah, I almost exclusively listen to hybrid memoirs on audio. Especially if they're read by they're narrated by the author, because then it's just like a cool friend telling you a fun story. I never listen to fiction. I don't hear super well, and I'm always nervous, like, oh, if I miss a sentence, that could be the clue that we need 500 pages from now. But if I'm listening to a memoir that has some sort of educational or historical component, then it's just like listening to a cool story. And if I like my cat makes a weird noise and I have to stop and pay attention to it for a second, then I can and I miss a sentence, I'm not freaked out by it.
What are you currently reading?
Besides Text Me When You Get Home, I'm reading this amazing book called Kill the Next One by Frederico Exatt, and it's translated by David Fry. And I read so much that I try to read really widely, and I try to read one translated book at least once a month or once every 2 months, and it's sort of like a David Lynch movie crossed with a thriller. Which is the white hot center of my wheelhouse. And it's this weird thriller where this guy, it opens up and he has a brain tumor and he's at the end of his life and he's like, all right, I'm going to kill myself. It's like trigger warnings for suicide, sort of. It gets kind of weird. And as he's like sitting there in his study with the gun, some guy's knocking on the door and he's like, oh, fucking Christ. Just go away. And the guy refuses to. And he opens the door and he's like, hey, I know you're going to kill yourself. I know everything about you. I know your name. Before you kill yourself, why don't you make yourself useful and kill this really bad guy? And then if you kill this other guy who wants to kill himself, someone will come and shoot you, so it won't look like a suicide. It's like a cool suicide club join. And then he does it. This is right at the beginning of the book, so it's not a big spoiler. And as you might expect, things aren't exactly as the guy who knocked on his door says it is, and it gets weirder and weirder and more compelling. I can barely put it down. I started it last night and I'm almost done. It's so good.
That's the thing that I find though lately is that when I do pick something up, I'll just plow through it. Like if it's, you know, pleasurable in any way. Like I read all of Margaret's Neon Green in two nights. And you know, I was so riveted. I really wanted to know what was going on with the spaceship.
Yeah.
I was like so like, you know, and I couldn't put it down.
It was like it's got great characters who like are fascinating, but like the central sort of what the fuck is going on really did pull me through.
That's the thing. I think it may have been conditioned by my increased TV consumption for relaxation, the bingeability of things.
Yeah.
That now I feel that I don't have the patience to kind of sit through or wait for a narrative to unfold. So now I will read books like I'm binging.
Margaret, what are you reading currently?
like Mallory, I like to have a few different books on the hopper and sometimes let them duke it out a little bit, you know, like see which one, like
the good one always rises to the top.
Right, exactly. And then you're like, oh, I'll get to those other ones later. But one that I just read was Rivka Galchin's Little Labors. So basically, after I had Silas, I wanted to know, I was really thirsty for books that were written by women deep in the throes of having a baby or around childbirth or just existing as a mom that were still like intellectually powerful and deep and just like riveting. And somehow I got to Little Labors. And, you know, this book is modeled after Say Shonigan's The Pillow Book, which the pillow book is something I teach in all of my nonfiction classes because I love it. It's a book that was written in the 900s, believe it or not, from a court lady in Japan who was serving Empress Teshi. And she basically just writes her observations, her kind of daily frustrations. And it's considered one of the forebearers of the modern essay. So Little Labors is based on that in the sense that it's these little fragments, it's these little observations from the depths and throes of having this little tiny infant who she refers to as the puma. Mm-hmm. So she talks about this feline animalistic creature coming into her home and just disrupting it upon entry. And the baby actually shapeshifts throughout the book. Sometimes it's a chicken. Sometimes, and most of the time it's a puma, but it does.
Real babies don't do that?
Not yet. I don't know. I don't know what Silas is doing. He clearly needs to get on it. But it's a book that's just really nice to dip into and fits and starts, which is perfect for me right now because I can't necessarily like sink 5 hours into something. But it's really beautiful in terms of its rigor. Like there's still a lot of intellectual ideas about like what it means to have a baby, what it means to sort of be in the culture as a mother. I just finished with that one and that was really great.
Let's go back a moment to the idea of dueling books, because I'm a really big fan of this. I always see one of them as a threat and one of them as a safe place to be. So there have been periods, like I generally have one book with me that is hard and one book with me that is easy. And I've basically, my bruisers are Swan's Way and Ulysses. I'll read anything else under the threat of having to read those books.
I was going to say, no wonder you're not reading them. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, the thing is like...
Just to read those with like a reading group. You can't even do it alone.
But the thing is, I'm never going to read Swan's Way, but I definitely am going to get through Cloud Atlas, though no one knows why, under the threat of Swan's Way.
That's actually how I get myself to go to the gym, because it's like, all right, I'll pick any activity. I'm like, oh, do I have to clean out my inbox? I'm like, oh, fine, go to the gym. It's like you trick yourself into doing the thing that you don't actually
I might be
do.
Having a book club this summer about A Swan's Way.
Oh, really?
Yes. And then separate from Pop Rocket, if I do that, you have to do it.
I would love to do that.
Okay.
Where do you like to purchase your books? God knows I go to the good people in Amazon too much. I'm embarrassed about it. I am defeating American capitalism with my choices. But it's just so nice to be like, oh, God, there was that one, like, Sikh lady suffragette in England. I need to get her biography and to just have Amazon make it come to my house 3 days later.
I know. I'm heavily reliant on Amazon. I do get a lot of books sent to me. That's one thing. So I often have a surplus of particularly classic literature from the 19th century. If anybody needs a spare copy of, Bronte's Villette.
Oh, I would love to get Wuthering Heights. I haven't read it, and I've been meaning to read it forever.
Yeah, I have multiple editions. So
brother, can you spare
that.
A Vatek?
Yeah. I still often will buy books more when I visit my local bookstore, and I will be ambitiously sort of feel charged to read it, even if I never do. So here in Los Angeles, that's Skylight Books.
Yes.
Where I think you've done a reading. Right?
I've done many readings there. I love them very much. Yeah. I'm a member of that bookstore, and they have a phenomenal selection.
Yes. And also the Last Bookstore downtown.
Hell yeah.
With a mix
of
used titles. Yeah.
They're fantastic, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, I do. And I will pop into a bookstore. Yeah,
book soup.
I'll pop into a bookstore when I'm traveling. That's something that I do tend to do is kind of peruse books when I'm traveling, even if I don't necessarily read them while I'm traveling.
Visiting an airport bookstore is such a wonderful check-in with America. Like, it really is like all those businessman books, but it's always great to see, like, hey, what, like, four pieces of classic, like, literary fiction are we reselling to people because of something going on in the zeitgeist?
Well, you know, Book Soup has an LAX hub in Bradley
International Terminal.
And one of the biggest joys and prides for me as a writer is when they had my book as one of their recommended picks on their table in LAX, which was amazing because, like, you know, I mean, it just isn't necessarily like an airport book. And I felt like, oh, great. Like anybody passing through LAX.
Like, sure, why not?
Yeah.
Since I finished my book, like before I started my book, I did not read a bunch of sort of like comedian memoir-y things. And then since I was done with it, I just can't stop reading them because I'm like, is mine worse than this?
Well, I was going to ask, I asked this of all of you guys, like the thing that you're working on, do you like to read books that are alongside that thing or do you want to get away from that?
I inhale them like crazy. I mean, part of the reason why I'm writing the book that I'm writing, it just worked out that way and it worked out better. But I also, that's the kind of biographies that I like to read, this kind of book that I like to read. And I read as many as I can get my hands on.
I find that for me writing Neon Green, like I read certain books that felt to me like major touchstones for that book. And then when I really was in the middle of writing it, I wanted nothing to do with those kinds of books.
So like what kind of books?
I mean, Don DeLillo was like a huge influence for me, particularly White Noise. And I read it a number of times, like in the beginning of writing the book. And then I had to stop because I had to like take out all the DeLillo fake lines that I had. Do you know what I mean? And I was like, I need to get them out of my head. It was like a boyfriend that I had to like break up with and be like, get out of my house. So I don't know. For me, it's like you got a divorce at some point.
Well, it's really tricky as writing as a scholar and then also writing a book for more general public consumption, right? So with The Carpenter's Book, of course, I had to like read the authoritative biographies, in part because the book is less about the writing the definitive biography than it is about like kind of conjuring speculations and fantasies attached to my own story through what's been said about Karen Carpenter, which is not unlike writing a kind of scholarly book on a topic like The Suburbs or Karaoke or what have you. Of course, so you have to read, essentially when you're writing a scholarly book, you're expected to read everything that's ever been written about the topic or adjacent to the topic. And so what you have to do is figure out a way to still, at least I make this effort, to still be able to thread a narrative through that people can access that isn't simply a recantation of, or excessively citational.
Yeah, that's the danger, right? I just find this even when I write celebrity profiles that I can read about them in the respective magazines, but then I sort of have to very much forget everything I just read. So that I say something original.
Well, that particularly because, I mean, that is a genre that is going to be repeated a dozen times every time they have a movie. And it's so easy to write the same thing.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, like, I've made fun of Margaret a number of times about celebrity interviews with what kind of salad did she pick at. Not that Margaret ever does this, but my favorite thing...
Never talk about their food unless I have to.
My favorite thing is just, like, a hack... interview of an actress that talks about how she devoured a cheese plate or picked at her salad.
What's a book that you all read over and over again? Do you have any of those?
I have because there's many. Few.
Yeah, so like you're like
a big rereader.
Once a year kind of or perennial that you bust out every now and then.
Have you ever heard of the Golden Compass series by Philip Pullman?
Oh, yes.
I read that every year because I read that when I was a kid, when I was like 9. And when I was 9, I was like, oh, this is a cool adventure story. And then I hit puberty and I was like, whoa, this is more than an adventure story. And then like I find that every year I relate to a different character and I get more out of it. And that story is so multi-layered. It's like, I always describe it as Chronicles of Narnia for little atheist children, which I very much was.
All right, I will say, I fucking loved the first of those books so much. But by the time I got to the third one, I was angry at the elephants on roller skates. Should I reread them? Am I not giving them giving the second and third book a fair shake?
I think you should, but I mean, what's interesting is my love for them has definitely evolved to the point where now that I read them as an adult, I'm like, all right, Philip Pullman, we get it. You're wicked into science. Okay, yeah, you hate God. Oh, yes, I get. Yes, Philip. Like, it's very blatantly a mouthpiece for atheism. Which is like, cool, dude, whatever. So there are things that you can kind of be like, oh, whatever. But the core story of Lyra will carry you through it.
For me, it is like charismatic criticism that really like calls to me most. Roland Barthes' Mythologies.
It's
the snappiest fucking book on the planet.
You guys are bringing me back to my MFA at Cal Arts.
But I mean, it's so good to realize this dude would like break shit down in 4 pages and then fucking move along. And it's so good. I have a couple of Pauline Kael collections and just like going through and not even thinking about the movies. She always does make me think about the movies in a different way, but it's more just seeing somebody pull apart culture. And then, like, Didion's Slouching Towards Bethlehem and Where I Was From. Like, I have to go back and look at Where I Was From every couple of years just to be like, California, what are you doing?
Oh, I know. I mean, Pauline Kael, I find her reviews are just eminently readable in a way that nobody else from The New Yorker has accomplished since then. We have a number of her books around, and, like, anytime we see, like, an old movie, like, we just look it up, see what she has to say. And it's not always, like, I don't always agree with her.
No,
like,
she seems to have hated movies, with the exception of like Nashville and Citizen Kane. Didn't particularly care for movies, but the clarity of mind to have your own goddamn opinion, regardless of what was floating around you, is what just sings through to me.
Yeah, and as a woman, like in the 70s, when there's like absolutely zero female film critics,
yeah,
remarkable.
One other thing I read 20 years ago and I'm currently rereading is the book Rolling the R's by
Ars of Moral Linmark. Yes. He's a friend of mine. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
When I read it, I was a closeted undergrad, and it is a book told in sort of communications and vernacular, and so much pop culture that it was too much for me as like a closeted 19-year-old. And I realized this book, which has loomed so large in my life, I needed to go back and say, hey, buddy, who are you? Because it was too much for me to take down when I didn't know myself.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a great book. And, you know, I think it just had its 20th anniversary a couple of years ago. I would highly recommend it, although it's written a lot in pigeon English. So it can feel inaccessible in those ways. But the pop culture in it is so resonant, especially for anyone who grew up in the 70s and early 80s.
The thing I hate and love about something that is written in non-standard English is I can't just blow through it. I have to think about what they're saying the whole time. And like, I remember being mad at Huck Finn because it wasn't a simple, easy read, but it made me like take note, you know?
Anyway.
I love rereading 2 books, and partially because I usually assign these book and fiction classes, but Blindness by Jose Saramago.
Yeah.
I fucking love that book. And I love the beginning in particular. Like the first 20 pages, I always assign as just, there is so much to talk about as an intro to a book and a story and like what you know and what you don't know and what the point of view is and the pacing of it. Like there is so much to study there. Also, and I have to credit Oliver Wang, our co-host from long ago, with this recommendation from James Baldwin, Another Country. Mm. So I've read many other Baldwin books. I mean, I love Goteld on the Mountain. That book is amazing and dear to my heart. But Another Country is one that he suggested a long, long time ago. And since then, I've read it probably 2 or 3 times.
Really?
And it's stunning. It is such a gorgeous book. Mm-hmm. And there's one point where it kind of departs and goes to Paris. Most of the time it's in Harlem. And it's so riveting and gives you such a clear picture of what Harlem was like in the 50s when these characters were running around with like no money and feeling all this like bohemian angst, and there's like jazz cigarettes and there's dirty fucking and it's great. And they go off to Paris at one point and I feel like the book loses just a teeny bit of steam, but otherwise to me it's like flawless.
Margaret, we have to follow that up with, what is your favorite celebrity biography or autobiography?
Oh man. You know, I don't know how to answer this because I don't read a ton of celebrity biographies, but I will say that when I was reviewing a lot more books professionally, I got assigned to review this book. I think it was called The Washingtonian, and it was this girl's blog.
I-E-N-N-E, The Washingtonian, right?
Yes. Yeah. And she had, like, dated a bunch of, like, senators or pages or some shit. I don't even remember anymore, but that book was so ridiculous and cheesecakey for, like, all of the, like, you know, Hollywood for the ugly people that came in and just did offensive things to her, but like all under the guise of like, you want to get ahead in politics, right? Like, let's just sleep together and then I'll never call you again kind of thing.
Okay, so there's this actress in the 60s, a Greek actress named Melina Mercouri.
And honey, you've talked about this before, but go for it, because you love this book. Like,
it's called,
you...
it was called I Was Born Greek, and it's like, it's fucking, it's like an actress, it's kind of like a pissy actress autobiography that turns into like a politician's statement of beliefs halfway through, and you like... couldn't meet my needs more. Mallory, do you have a favorite celebrity autobiography or biography?
I don't really read all the memoirs I read are by like writers, and filmmakers. I don't even know if I've ever read one by a celebrity, which is weird because I read so much.
What is the most painful book you've ever had to get through?
This is a special treat for you guys because on my show, we have me and Bria, my co-host, we have a very strict policy. We don't talk about books that we hate.
Okay.
So this is a Pop Rocket exclusive that you guys are getting. Normally, I dump books that I don't like. I have a very... I'm very staunch about the fact that I'm like, I'm going to die someday. I don't like finishing books.
Life is too short for that kind of shit.
Oh, dump that shit. Dump that book. That is like our slogan, like dump that book. But I hate read a book last summer that it was so horrible that I was like, I have to, it's like a train wreck. I got popcorn. I was like, this is so terrible. And it was The Vor by B. Catling. And it's like the super highbrow, very literary genre fantasy sci-fi horror book. But it was so misogynist.
Yikes.
That it was like the misogyny was like a grand spectacle. It was like watching an explosion. I was like, I must read this. And then my boyfriend read it and he was like, this is so terrible. I must read it. Like, there's a scene in the very beginning where he's a 12-year-old boy and he was raised by these robots and he like hits puberty. And for the very first time, he loses his virginity to this robot that was specifically designed to bang him. And he bangs the robot so good that he makes the robot come, even though it's actually impossible for the robot to do that. And I was like, this is like the most insane male fantasy
that
I've ever heard in my life. This is so bad.
What happens when a robot comes?
She had to go clean herself in the sink, in like the special robot sink.
Can I share my favorite book, Misogyny?
It better be better than robot sex. The bar's way up high right now.
I mean, I'm not gonna get over that bar. But I have to say, Pulitzer Prize winner, The Hours by Michael Cunningham.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
The first time I read that book, I was like, this is so good. The second time I read it, it's like, why do women only talk about gay guys? there is that way that with TV or movies, there are actually people acting shit out, so there's at least that level of reality, where for me it is so much easier for books to just tear apart at a point, like Possession by A.S. Byatt, a book that I love, but her representations of how a male's brain works about sex are so much from an old English lady that I have to be like, ugh, and just put it down for a while.
Don't you feel like, The Hours is kind of a little purple prose, right?
Yes.
I mean, I have the credit among my friends for going to see that movie with a group of people and laughing really loudly when Ed Harris dies. Because it was so corny. I couldn't handle it.
On the subject of purple prose, has anyone here ever read any Pat Conroy?
Oh, no. For sure. I've read a lot of Pat Conroy.
Oh, those fucking sentences.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, you think that...
If you write about cowboys, though, you can do whatever the fuck you want.
Well, but you think about, like, Nick Nolte's closing speech in Prince of Tides, or, like, his inner monologue when he's talking about, it whispers through the trees, Lowenstein, Lowenstein. You know, I mean, the whole book is like that. But I really enjoyed it, and I think that for a period of time... When I was in high school, I was really into romantic with a capital R poetry. I thought I was going to be a romanticist in grad school until I became a prudish Victorianist. And so, like, I was really into the kind of big sentimental stuff. I mean, I wrote a whole chapter talked about Oscar Wilde in my dissertation.
Oh,
of course
good
I would
for
put purple.
You,
you know, so that's why I read Pat Conroy. And also because
I think
Princess
you also
Guys.
Have a little, you have a little soft spot for schmaltz, I feel like.
My entire center is gooey with schmaltz.
Yeah.
Is there ever anything that you just picked up and before you realized what you were doing, you were done with a book?
All the time.
Go for it.
Oh, man. Actually, so me and my podcast co-host are doing an event next month at the Last Bookstore with this author, Paul Tremblay, who's a friend of mine, but he wrote both of two books that he wrote, A Head Full of Ghosts and Cabin at the End of the World, which comes out next month. I read them in one sitting. Uh-huh. All of a sudden, I put them down and I was like, I couldn't do anything. I was like surgically attached to this book for 6 hours and I was just blown away.
I mean, one time I was at whatever the good big bookstore in Portland is.
Powell's.
I was at Powell's and it was when everyone was talking about the Tiger Mom book and I got the Tiger Mom book to look at it and like, by the time I like checked my watch, I had read two-thirds of it and was like, well, you better.
Gotta buy it now.
Yeah, so I bought another copy and I just took it down.
I don't know. I've just been forced to speed read so many things. But like that, you know, like I don't think that happens to me very often. Also because like my whole life is to be just so attentive as a reader at all times that sometimes that's why I turn to things like celebrity biography or autobiography because I'm just like, oh, I could let that detail go.
You want to know what was a delightful read, but also so much more than I expected it to be was Dave Holmes' Party of One. Like during this period of reading sort of like memoir-y things, it was like, oh, he's a gay guy and I have lied to him about having read this book several times. and then I read it and it was like full of the bracing honesty that you kind of don't expect from books like that or from former MTV VJs. And it was like delightfully pop culture-y, but mostly just the fact that like gay men particularly, we write a lot of memoirs, but I don't know that we are good at being honest in them. And he talked about the uncomfortable stuff and it was really nice.
That's great. You got to go uncomfortable in a memoir or else why are you doing it?
Margaret, it's summertime. Do we do anything with books during the summertime?
We sure do. So I want to talk about the Pop Rocket Summer Book Club. And Mallory, I'm hoping you're gonna read with us this year.
Hell yeah.
I mean, it sounds like you read a lot. So, I mean, you can
hitch me to that wagon.
Yeah, you can get this done on a Thursday. So this year, I think my concept is going to be that we read a book that's soon going to be a movie or TV show, I should say. So I came up with some contenders and I might add some things to this. We always vote on it on the Facebook group. So if you're not part of that, get on there so that you can vote and have a say. But here are the books I'm looking at so far. Dietland by Sari Walker, which is going to be an AMC series from Marty Noxon starting in just a couple of weeks. So we'd have to get on that one real fast. Crazy Rich Asians, I mean, duh, like it's coming out as a movie with Constance Wu. It's Kevin Kwan's bestseller. My Abandonment by Peter Rock. It's going to be the movie Leave No Trace by Deborah Gratnick, who is the director of Winter's Bone. And this is her return after 8 years, and it was an absolute Sundance darling. Boy Erased by Gerard Conley. That's a memoir of his parents sending him to gay conversion therapy. Basically, his Baptist pastor dad sends him to go get straight, son. And the dad is played by Russell Crowe, which has me kind of stroking my chin like, is that okay? And Nicole Kidman is the mom. The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters, which Sarah Waters now has been a contender in like one or two of our Pop Rocket book clubs, and she hasn't quite made the cut. So maybe this will be her
fantastic year.
But yeah, so she's got this novel that is set in rural England post-World War II. The movie is going to be with Domhnall, I'm probably saying that wrong, some Irish person, you know, correct me, Domhnall Gleeson as a country doctor called to treat a patient at Hundreds Hall, a decaying estate that seems to be haunted. It just seems to be haunted. I'm sure it's not.
Yeah.
So those are the five books that I'm eyeing right now. What do you guys think off the top of your heads?
It's very exciting. I would like to say after the debacle that I brought to the table last year, I promise I will read this book, and I'm sorry.
Yes, you will read this book. I'll make sure.
I'm on Team Sarah Waters or Crazy Rich Asians, because I remember seeing Crazy Rich Asians on my friend's bookshelf, like 7 years ago or something like that, and it was just like, "What's this?"
And I know, right? it had a good cover.
Yeah, it had
that,
a good
like,
cover.
So, yeah. Silhouette cover was very eye-catching.
I mean, it's currently in my car. I should read it, but
everybody go run out and read everything Sarah Waters has ever written.
I'm really biased because I want to say Little Stranger. I just think summer is a really good time for people to start, like, especially people who are like, "Oh, I don't want to read horror books. That's too creepy." Reading it on the beach, like while you're drinking a pina colada, is probably the best entry point to horror. So I feel like it's a good time.
Cancels out like some of the creep factor where you're like, you know, with people on the beach, what could go wrong? You're not going to get murdered. It's cool.
Unless you're reading Jaws.
True.
Then you're going to die.
All right. One more question. Most overrated author or book?
Charles Bukowski.
Okay. I was going to say Charles Bukowski also.
When we get out of here, we're high-fiving.
Yeah.
I just read this amazing book called The Pisces by Melissa Broder.
Oh, I want to read that so bad.
Oh my God, it's so good. It's one of my favorite books of the year, but I'm not spoiling anything. It's really like right up front. Like there's a book about her falling in love with this merman in Venice Beach, and it's very like LA millennial Tinder culture, like sadness and desperation. It's so good. But there's this hilarious moment where I was like, you ever have that like one moment where you read a line and you're like, I love this book. Me and this book are together forever, where she's talking to the merman. And before she'll like get close to him, she's like, do you know who Charles Bukowski is? And he's like, no. And she's like, okay, cool. I was like, I love this book so much. Yeah. I think all Charles Bukowski's poems, like everyone thinks he's so deep because he's so gritty and raw, but it's just like, there's a dog pissing on a wall and a lady and she's naked. And all these like, you know, mid-20 bros are like, oh, he's so deep and raw.
I totally agree with you guys, yet I like the movie Barfly, which is about Charles Bukowski. I don't understand.
That's an interesting thing because I actually love, one of my weird rules about memoirs is I love reading memoirs and watching biopics of people I don't know anything about.
Yeah.
So I would totally watch a movie
about
Bukowski.
You should watch Barfly. Have you seen it?
No.
It's good.
But I
mean, it's Mickey O'Rourke, like back in the day.
And The Smog Cutter, my former local.
Yes,
was actually
it's super gritty, like 80s LA scenery.
It closed recently.
Margaret, do you have a nominee for most overrated author or book?
Oh, God.
Just hop on the Bukowski train. It's 2 out of 4.
I mean, it was so easy to go. My friend, her at the time boyfriend, kept buying her Bukowski books for Christmas. And she was just like, fuck this.
Okay.
Maybe we should break up.
So, quick story. When I, like, long before I met my partner, when I was on LA Tinder for like a year, I had this weird art project that I never ended up doing anything with it, but I kept going on these horrible Tinder dates and guys would be like, oh, you like books, and they would try to impress me and they would buy me a copy of a Bukowski book. And I started this collection of them. Some of them bought me women.
Oh, God.
Which was crazy. And I was like, I need to do something with all these books. And finally, I was like, I'm just going to throw them away.
I used to have on my dating profile long ago a rule where if you were to write me, you had to name 3 books by women.
That's amazing.
That's awesome.
No Brokowskis.
It really did cut the boys from the men. Do you know what I mean?
That's like, wonderful.
Yeah, it was. I would have to say overrated. I mean, this is kind of in line. You guys are inspiring me. Jack Kerouac. I mean, mm-hmm. On the Road. I do like certain things about On the Road, but the fact that there's like only one female character and she does their laundry is like just fuck off.
As a tender boy, I started reading On the Road because I was like, this is something, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we all tried. We all gave it a good shot.
It was a horrifying realization. After you referencing profiles like that, I just have to, one last thing. Margaret, have you checked your Black Swan dating profile in the recent past?
I need to go look at it. I hope she's gotten married by now and is happy.
All right. Get on Facebook and let us know what you're reading and how you read. And also, please...
Don't get mad at us for not talking about Ellen and Ferrante.
And also, please vote. Please vote for the summer book so we know what we're supposed to read. All right. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back after this.
Are stacks of unread books taking over your apartment?
Do you constantly miss your train stop because you're caught up in reading?
I'm Bria Grant.
And I'm Mallory O'Mara.
We party hard.
And by party hard, we mean read books.
So join us every Thursday on Reading Glasses, a Maximum Fun podcast about reading and book culture.
Get more out of your reading life.
We'll help you conquer your to-be-read pile.
Get out of that book slump.
And squeeze more reading time into your busy day.
Learn how to read better.
Wow, that was good.
Thank you. Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Margaret Wappler.
Karen Tongson.
And Mallory O'Mara.
And every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? So I turn to Mallory O'Mara and I ask her, what's your current jam?
The band A Perfect Circle just dropped a new album that I'm really, really crazy about. And they have this one song on there called Hourglass. And I feel like if the Grim Reaper was a pole dancer, this would be his song. And it's just, I can't stop listening to it. I love it so much. Red flag red, all the sentinels are dead. The Chokio kitties swallow rose and canary. Tick, 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 do you recognize the sound? As the grains count down, trickle down right in front of you. Tickle, tickle, tickle on your neck.
That's going to hit the runway at Jumbo's any day now.
I'm waiting for it. I got my dollar bills ready for that.
Jumbo's Clown Room is a semi-famous trashy strip club here in Los Angeles, I am told.
Apparently Courtney Love danced there
at one
point.
She used to dance there at one point, apparently. Yeah.
In the spirit of the show, I actually have a friend who likes to read there. Yeah. It's like his favorite reading spot.
Yeah. Karen, you got a jam?
Yes, I do, and it returned to me from actually a recent episode of the last season of The Americans, episode 6, and it is one of Tears for Fears' earliest songs from their first album, The Hurting, in 1983, and it's called Ideas as Opiates, and I just love a screaming Roland Orzabal. Say what you want. Say what you want. Say what you want. This is from the same album as Pale Shelter and Mad World. It's very much of that style, but I really was stunned by how much it captured the sort of tension and alienation between Elizabeth and Philip in that episode. Anyway, listen to the whole album, The Hurting, and watch The Americans.
You and The Americans. This week I pass because I am existing in a state of abstention in preparation for the summer jam search.
A fasting period.
Yes, I'm like a monk.
Yes.
So, Margaret Wappler, what do you got jam-wise?
I have a jam that is probably my favorite Madonna song if I really just had to put all my chips on it. And this is Borderline. So the reason Borderline came back into my mind, though, this week is because the writer of the song, Reggie Lucas, passed away last week at age 65. And he has a really interesting history as a musician in general. He was Miles Davis's guitarist for a while in 1972. And eventually, fast forward over to 1983, because he's a big deal at this point, he gets called in to produce this little unknown named Madonna. And he comes into her tiny East Village apartment and says that she's vivacious and has all this energy and she's just crackly, and he finds her really interesting, and he ends up producing most of the songs on her self-titled debut, like Lucky Star, Burning Up, that was all him. But the song that he wrote is Borderline. So here it is.
Been there for us so long.
Oh, God, I love it. This is one of my karaoke favorites, too, I have to say. And I really like the idea of thinking about Madonna's first album, or, you know, first, the big debut, being produced by Miles Davis guitarist.
Yeah.
This is the kind of connections in music that we don't often think about or pay attention to, but it's real and it's part of the history. So RIP, Reggie Lucas.
It's beautiful. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Margaret Wappler, Karen Tongson, and Mallory O'Mara. Mallory, where can people learn more about you?
You can listen to my podcast, Reading Glasses, which is also on Maximum Fun. You can find me on basically every social media handle at Mallory O'Mara, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, sort of all over the internet, just under my name.
Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Mallory, thank you for coming and doing this.
Thank you for having me.
As bad host. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us because Margaret looks pale.
My hormones need to be rebalanced, guys. I need your reviews.
Her blood iron levels. And get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket. Join our Facebook group and get in the discussion. Come visit our Instagram. Karen Tongson and Margaret Wappler are keeping it alive.
Pop Rocket Podcast at Pop Rocket Podcast.
We are a production of MaximumFun.org. The show is edited by Julian Burrell. I don't know that I've met him. And our producer is Laura Swisher, whom I've known for decades.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.